Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inch and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with John Menzon Santos. He is someone who for more than 20 years now has been an activist on social and policy issues, particularly affecting Asian Americans. He served as executive director of the two largest nonprofits in North America, working on issues of sexual health and HIV among Asians and Pacific Islanders. He's also been involved in a number of other organizations that deal with issues affecting immigrants and migrants, with the deaf community, with substance abusers, a variety of other kinds of issues. In 2006, he established Pearl Diving. That's a consulting practice focusing on values-based strategy and sustainability for individuals and organizations. And then, as I mentioned, between 1991 and 2006, he was the executive director of Asian and Pacific Islander Wellness Center. That's in the San Francisco Bay Area, and also the Asian and Pacific Islander Coalition on HIV/AIDS. That's in New York City. And he is here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk. Actually, gave the talk last night. This is the Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights and Asian Americans. The first one, in fact, took place, and there'll be now one every year going forward. And the idea is to bring people to talk about issues of marginality and oppression, particularly experienced within Asian American communities. And we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us. Questions, of course, are welcome always. We are happy to bring people into the conversation. You can join us by calling 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I'd like to just have you talk a little bit about yourself. I guess I'm always curious about people and how they, you know, how their lives end up taking the path that they do and how they end up doing what they do. Tell me and tell us a little bit about your background. I know that's a pretty open-ended question.
I'm just taking a breath first. So I was born in the house my father built. No, I won't start there. But I think life's path is definitely windy, and we don't always know where we're going to end up, where that point B is. But I think part of how I've gotten to the point I've gotten is the times we live in. And so I think when I was coming of age as a teenager, it was interesting. I was, I'm here in Champaign-Urbana, invited by the Asian American Studies program on campus. And I wasn't Asian identified until I was about 20, 21 years old. And so up until that point, I was, you know, I was born in the United States. And I think a lot of listeners might be able to identify with this experience. My parents came to this country after World War II from the Philippines. And they really wanted to make sure we were American. So that meant, you know, it's a typical immigrant experience, I think. They didn't think that if we spoke another language other than English, we would fit in or we would be able to get a job. We might speak English with an accent and thus be behind. So I grew up thinking I was white. I grew up thinking I wasn't different than the other kids in school. Ironically, I did a junior abroad in Italy, of all places, in Bologna, Italy, and people would ask me, where are you from? And I would say, well, I'm from the United States. I was born in Augusta, Georgia. I grew up in San Francisco. And they'd say, no, where are you really from? So people saw me as Asian American, in fact. Mm-hmm. And I started to, there was a seed planted that, maybe I wasn't white, in fact. So when I came back to the United States, I think being, grappling with questions of identity around a lot of things, I'm Asian American. I knew I was gay from an early age, so I thought that was the main issue or identity that I'd have to kind of deal with through my life. And in the late 80s, around this time, being gay also meant being associated with HIV/AIDS. That was the main sort of media association that people had, people on the street. Mm-hmm. One thing that I mentioned last night was how Rock Hudson came into people's houses. He was the matinee idol that star of stage and screen, not so much stage, but little and big screens anyway. And when he developed HIV/AIDS, that he was one of the first gay people that people learned about. So how I got to where I am is definitely taking on the identity as a gay man and all that that meant socially, politically, and health-wise. Hmm. And my entree into getting involved in the gay community happened to be AIDS activism.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people would agree that the best tool that we have to deal with the spread of HIV and AIDS is education. That is, well, maybe you wouldn't agree. I would think a lot of people would say, yeah, that people have to understand this disease, have to understand how it's transmitted. And for all of that, to do that, you got to get people talking. You got to get people talking about things that are maybe not easy to talk about. They're uncomfortable talking with because it deals with sexuality. You were now involved in these two different organizations that specifically had to do with addressing issues around HIV and AIDS in the Asian American community. How difficult was that in within the Asian community? Has it been a difficult thing to get people just to talk about sex and what people do and with whom they do it and why that should matter?
Well, the short answer is definitely yes. I think not only in Asian American communities, but all communities have taboo subjects, right? And I think with anything, whether it's AIDS or any issue that's important, but that there's stigma around it, what's critical is what the message is and who the messenger is. So, yes, information is the most important tool that we have. But if the information isn't coming from some place where a community thinks is credible, a source that a community thinks is credible, that's a problem. So there can be bus shelter ads or things on buses or people talking about AIDS in the mainstream media. But if they don't see themselves, if they don't see their faces, if they don't see their languages, it doesn't affect them. And so the unique issues that we've had in the Asian and Pacific Islander community, especially in the United States, is that people speak dozens of languages. People think that it's a gay disease, that it's a white disease, that it's a Western disease. And when you have immigrants and refugees from other places outside the United States, it's very easy to discount the message that it's not for me, right? Mm-hmm. So in these organizations that I've had the privilege of working with and running, it was all about how to figure out how to make the issue real and how to make it relevant and how to recruit the credible voices in the community. So we want to make it so that people are so such good denial breakers. You know, so if you have, for example, famous Asian people who are saying, no, it is in our community, listen to me and say it in your language. I mean, we're going to have better chances of breaking through that denial, especially where stigma is such a part of something like HIV/AIDS. Like you mentioned, it's associated with all these things we just don't talk about at the dinner table, sex and sexuality and drugs and illness and death. So when you have all of those things wrapped up, it's easy not to talk about it. Who wants to talk about it? Mm-hmm. And I can share a little bit about maybe some of the successes and one in particular. We're a small but mighty 4% of the population in the United States, Asians are. Mm-hmm. And so what we thought was we've got to not just focus on the San Francisco community. We've got to work with partners across the country and reach communities in a broad scale way. So we developed a national campaign. It was called the Banyan Tree Project. And the goal of the campaign is to raise awareness around the stigma and discrimination that people with HIV face in the Asian and Pacific Islander communities. So the Lightning Rod event, we got the federal government to acknowledge. We created a day, a special day, a National Asian and Pacific Islander HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. And that's for all of you with your PDAs and calendars, is May 19th every year. And the first year was in 2005. So what was great about that is that in 6 cities across the country, in Boston, Chicago, New York, L.A., Honolulu and San Francisco, where the flagship event was, there were these commemorations on this day, federally sanctioned Awareness Day around HIV and AIDS. Kind of like a World AIDS Day for the Asian and Pacific Islander community. In San Francisco, we had a panel of different luminaries, including Greg Louganis, the Olympic gold medalist. He's part Samoan, so even to see someone who identifies as Pacific Islander in part, who is openly HIV positive, you know, was a media draw. Mm-hmm. Another media draw was actually the actor Russell Wong, who starred in films like The Joy Luck Club and The Last Emperor. And Russell's case was interesting because the existence of the day actually got him to talk with his family. Because what he did when he came on the panel was he came out as having a brother who has been living with HIV for 18 years. And what was so extraordinary about that is that Russell, the famous person, gets the media in English and Chinese to the event, and people were on his every word. And when he said that he had a brother, what was great about that was not that it was almost better than him himself having HIV, because he was modeling the family member, the supportive family member around the person with HIV, because more people just statistically are going to be able to identify with the person around or next to the person with HIV. Mm-hmm. So to fight stigma, we said, here's a model of someone who, this is how you do it. You embrace that you know someone and love someone in your life who's HIV positive. You touch them and hug them the same way that you always have. And you're going to model for other people, say, oh, it's okay to share water glasses. It's okay to not kick them out of the house. It's okay to continue as you always have. So in some ways, the fighting stigma with the people who are HIV negative but are close to people who are HIV positive was a really effective strategy. And we did that nationally so that we would do public service announcements that got on cable TV. So they reached tens of millions of people. They were on MTV and the Discovery Channel and Court TV, and people watched these shows. And here you see these images of Asians who are family members and friends of positive people. Mm. And it made a big, big difference. And if I may make a connection, we saw that in the mainstream community with Rock Hudson. When Rock Hudson came out in 1985, here was Elizabeth Taylor. Like, people could say, I'm not Rock Hudson. I'm not gay. You know, I don't have AIDS. I'm not sick. But people worship Elizabeth Taylor. And when she was touching and hugging Rock on, you know, on cameras, those flash bulbs were clicking. They sort of said, ah, Elizabeth Taylor, I want to be her. I want to be like her. And she's touching and hugging Rock Hudson. It must be okay to touch and hug a person with HIV. That was an incredible anti-stigma moment for all of us, yeah. What Elizabeth Taylor did. The Elizabeth Taylor effect, I like to say.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, John Manzon Santos. He has been an activist for a long time. In 2006, he established a consulting practice that focuses on values-based strategy and sustainability for individuals and organizations. That's Pearl Diving. And then before that, for a number of years, he served as executive director of two organizations, one in the San Francisco Bay Area and one in New York, really the two largest nonprofits in North America that focus on issues of sexual health and HIV in the Asian and Pacific Islander community. He also worked as a counselor and trainer at something called Project Reach, a multiracial youth organizing center on the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And he's also been involved in other kinds of nonprofit boards and advisory bodies that advocate for immigrants, migrants, substance abusers, the deaf community, a lot of different kinds of organizations with different kinds of issues. He's here visiting the campus. He gave a talk last night. This was the first of what will be an annual event, the Bhalgopal Lecture on Human Rights and Asian Americans. And here we're talking some about him and about his work. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Certainly the organization that you're working with, and I think probably all kinds of nonprofit organizations like that that have some particular issue that they're interested in advocating for, all really face the same question to start out, and that is, how can we get people's attention? Not only can we get the attention of maybe a kind of a target group, but how can we get the attention broadly focused of everybody? You know, how do you get people even to listen to you so that you can say, hey, we have something here that's really important, and we at least would like you to hear what we have to say. And you talked about one of the strategies that you were able to use, and maybe that's just a reality, is that you have to get somebody who already has some kind of public stature, because that will get people's attention. How do you go about meeting that kind of challenge, no matter what issue it is, where what you're really trying to do is to get people's attention? And there are so many voices out there shouting at people trying to get their attention. You know, how do you make yourself heard?
It's a good question. And I think it in something like something stigmatized like HIV or a life-threatening condition, something that people and families really need to hear about. Yeah, there is a lot of competition for our attention. And in some ways, the national stigma campaign I mentioned is something that this is kind of a maturation of work over, 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's not where we start. Really, when organizations, especially community-based, service-oriented, activist-oriented organizations start, it's really about each person or each family, affecting each person, each family. So even before we're able to enlist the media's help and support, getting the word out, a lot of times it's on the ground and just taking care of people who come through the door. So that's really the first thing. And you build credibility in the community just by word of mouth, because that's the audience I'm first concerned with. Do people who receive services or are people's lives transformed enough that it's a net positive and they're able to tell people in their own lives, yes, I was able to receive help and this is the way I did it. The more people you help, the more people who you are able to provide services to, then there's energy created. There's kind of a critical mass of people. And they get to be the people who feel comfortable. And I'm talking about, for example, people with HIV. They get to be the best spokespeople for their own situation. And slowly but surely, there are people who come out and are able to come on the radio, or people who are able to write letters to their legislators, or talk to their priests, or the community leaders in their lives, and can raise awareness that way. So it's a very slow process, actually. How do we get people's attention? I mean, it's really from the ground up. It's really each person, we're all connected through these networks. And sure, we can hear a radio ad, and maybe I'll think about it for the time that the radio ad is running, but then, I'll forget about it. But if someone in your life who you deal with daily or weekly is talking about an issue, you're going to pause and say, this person volunteers at this organization. Maybe I should think about what they're doing, ask them more questions about it. That kind of constant exposure to something, that's when people, I think, start to think what's important. We think what's important is what people around us think is important, right? So how do we make mm-hmm. decisions in our lives? I ask my friends, I ask my family, I ask people I trust, I ask people I respect. And this is no different than how do we figure out, how to get the word out about something that's important to me. If I'm working at an organization, like a nonprofit organization that has a wonderful mission, then I'm going to be talking to people in my life about it,
Mm-hmm. This, I'm sure that one tends to underestimate how difficult it is to build an organization like that when you're starting from the grassroots, the kind of things that we talked about, a community-based, social service organization that maybe not only is interested in advocating for a particular issue and building public awareness, but actually providing some services to people. We're talking about a big challenge and something that I suppose could take a long time and struggling to survive probably for a long time before it gets to the point where it's solid enough and you have some sources of support, because you got to have money to run it. It must take an awful long time to build an organization like that. And I expect that with Pearl Diving, maybe that's part of what you're trying to do, is to actually help people who are trying to do that.
That's right. I think organizations are, you know, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations in the country. There are more than a million. And but that includes big churches as well as mom and pop, neighborhood, all volunteer run organizations as well. It does take a lot of, you know, these nonprofit organizations are actually corporations. So you have to, you know, file certain papers. There's this whole legal aspect to mm-hmm. running organizations. But I think it starts with people having a mission, people having a vision of a world they want to see and make a small difference in it. And you don't have to grow up to be as big as a YMCA. You can stay small, and you don't have to hire staff and have a payroll. You can just have volunteers, you know, take care of the things that need to be taken care of. So it really depends on what kind of cause you're talking about. This consulting practice that's just starting up, it is trying to figure out how big to be, how small to be. You know, are you going to be faithful to, you know, your original mission? Are you going to chase dollars just because there's funding out there? It's really a tricky thing to not get too big, too fast. There's, you know, it's not one size fits all when you're a nonprofit. You really want to figure out what you want to do and then have a plan for how big to grow and what kind of impact you want to make. If I want to, you know, fix world hunger, you know, you got to start small. You can't go that big immediately. So really what I'm trying to say is that when, in my experience, what I can do based on what I've seen with a lot of nonprofits is I have a pretty good sense of what it takes at what stage of an organization's development. So hopefully that can, you know, the experience I've had on the job can translate into others who are just helping. They want to make a difference, but they don't know how to do it in the framework of an organization. And it's not rocket science.
Yeah. I'm sure that even if you have a small organization and you're starting out with modest goals, you've got to have some money. You can't do everything with volunteers. You are going to have some expenses. So going after some funding is going to be an issue. And I think that probably it's also true that once you have some sort of organized structure to do that, then I guess I wonder, do you worry that you get to a point where raising money becomes an end in itself, that you put so much work into building a structure that you can use to raise money, that grows and grows. So, and you can't go back. Once you've got a certain amount of money and you're doing things with that, you don't want to scale back what you're doing. I think you probably always think about, now, what more can we do? But if we do more, well, we're going to need to have some more money. And that seems to me that can get to be like the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill. And pretty soon it consumes, just raising money consumes an awful lot of your time and effort.
Well, I'd say two things. First, that there really are a lot of efforts out there, grassroots efforts that stay volunteer. And they do tremendous work without a dollar. They do it, you know, or they kick in expenses where they can, but they really don't aspire to hiring staff or having infrastructure, you know, all the things that are required for, you know, starting a business, a nonprofit business even. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of nonprofits that are purely volunteer run. There is, I think, especially in fields like AIDS, we've seen that the need is so great that people want to do more. And when you do more, you kind of have to, you know, invest more to deliver more service. And it's true what you're saying, that they've become fundraising machines. I mean, I think we're all familiar with them. It seems like, why, you know, wait, what are you doing again? All you're doing is asking me for money. You know, we kind of lose the eye on the prize. And it is, unfortunately, a reality of a lot of organizations that, especially now, there are, I mean, even the radio stations, you know, we hear the funding drives. True. I don't know. Are you familiar with radio station funding drives
at
all?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Quite.
Okay. So we know what world we're talking about. But, you know, it's a balance. Like, how do you make sure to remind people that this is valuable, that you're getting something out of, and you got to take care of business. And so you're not doing 55-minute an hour drives, but you've got to do that 5 minutes, you know. So it is a balance. It is a sad thing, actually, when organizations get so big that it seems all about the fundraising, all about the fundraising. And I think for every organization I've seen that really does a good job, there are another five that don't do as good a job, you know. And I think that's the perception that you're talking about, that you know, it seems like all we're doing is, and you hear the scandals that come out too. You know, some CEO of a nonprofit or any company, where's the money really going? People get cynical. People don't want to give. The next time a nonprofit that's doing good work that could really stretch that dollar is asking, then, you know, their message isn't being heard. So, mm-hmm. You know, it is tricky. It is a risk. But, you know, nonprofit organizations, you know, even the word nonprofit, right? They seem kind of like the proverbial stepchildren of the for-profit sector, right? For-profit sector knows what to do. Nonprofits, you know, they're just kind of, you know, limping along, trying to do a good thing, right? Yeah. And I think that reputation harms the sector because it means that maybe we're not... we don't get the kind of resources. We don't get the kind of talent that people want to, you know, you think people want to make money and they want to go into the private sector. Well, the nonprofit sector, sometimes called the independent sector, is just as viable, you know, a career path or just as viable. I mean, it's about 16.8% of the gross domestic product the nonprofit sector is. So it does an incredible amount of work in the United States. So there's a little bit of a reputation that we always have to, those of us in the nonprofit sector always have to combat, including if the resources are going to a good cause. You know, one thing that I would say to listeners as well is that we can all be good consumers, you know, where we invest our money. So before people give money, you know, if you're concerned about where the money's going, you know, go online or find out how much of that dollar is being spent on program, you know, actual service delivery. And if you think that too high of the percentage is going to, quote unquote, overhead or these other costs, by all means, you know, call and ask questions or look somewhere else. So hold your nonprofit organizations accountable. You know, they deserve to be held accountable because the work they do is deserving. But we also have to be good consumers and good partners with them.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm interested in having you talk about is role for government and governmental agencies and addressing some of the same issues that nonprofits do. And I guess my thought is something like this, that there are people who will argue that because there are these nonprofits that are dealing with real needs in society, that they're perfectly capable of doing that and that the government doesn't really need to. You know, some people make the argument that, in fact, that organizations, you know, small nonprofits, social service organizations, maybe some of them aren't all that small. I mean, as you say, there are some that are actually really big organizations. But that they can do the work so the government doesn't have to. And, you know, I wonder about that, whether... that, you know, in some people's minds, it becomes a justification for government pulling back from certain areas or not spending in certain areas. And then the nonprofits, they have to kind of try and take up the slack as they can. Now, I suppose it's possible that they can make their money go further because there are people who are willing to do the work for free as volunteers or for very small salaries. And maybe that is an advantage that nonprofits have, that people aren't demanding huge amounts of money to do the work. But I wonder about this, can they actually pick up the slack if government says, well, look at all these great grassroots local organizations that are doing this work. That's fine. They're doing a great job. I guess we really don't have to.
You know, there is a tension. There is a tension there because if you think about how a lot of nonprofits, especially let's talk about social service organizations that sprang up, let's say, for example, during the 60s, the government got out of the business of providing public welfare, which it should have been doing. So it's true now that it looks like the nonprofit sector is taking up the slack, but it was because the government wasn't doing its job. And I know for all the concerns about big government and what, the government spends too much, nonprofits have filled in the gaps, but it was because there was little choice. And if the government was actually caring about delivering services in multiple languages to the Asian and Pacific Islander community, for example, if the government was, and just going on my own basic experience here, was concerned about the AIDS epidemic early on and providing quality care to people with AIDS, then there wouldn't need to be AIDS organizations or there wouldn't need to be Asian-based community organizations trying to take up that slack. You could say the government abdicated its responsibility of providing welfare for the public. I mean welfare in the capital W sense, but taking care of its residents. And so, sure, what happens? The nonprofit sector gets grants from the government. And you have, if you work for the government, a lot of times there are better benefits, better salaries. And then if you go to the nonprofit sector, there aren't as many of those kinds of safeguards. That's why we talk about, you go to the nonprofit sector and you don't earn as much money, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why don't the same standards of for workers in government apply to nonprofit sector? And, as an aside, if you look at where the big unions are going, they're looking at the nonprofit sector because they see what you've mentioned, that they're not being paid as much, and why not? Why aren't they being paid like they're being paid at the government level, this tension is constant. 80% of the organization's budget that I was running came from government. So it was tremendous amount of work also to, and this is from federal, city, and state governments, to apply and compete for money from the government and do all those, reporting requirements. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky because, do we hold the government accountable for not delivering the services itself, or do we say they're not going to do a good job, so we need to do it anyway? So it's that constant tension. But in AIDS especially, we saw the government not only not investing in AIDS services, but we also saw the government not discuss AIDS at all. So there weren't even pots of money for nonprofits to apply for. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I guess though, I think it's an interesting point here that nonprofits are still really dependent on government money. I mean, and yes, we have the perception that nonprofits are always out here, they're having to beat the bushes trying to get people to give them money, and it's true. I mean, you have to do that. You've got to go out and see if you can find money, people who are willing to give you money, and then once they've given you money, you can't let them alone because you always figure maybe they'll give you some more money. But, even though nonprofits spend a lot of time doing that, and when we think about that, what percentage are, I don't even know if you can answer a question like this. Say you look at nonprofits, how much on the average is the budget of nonprofit organizations, particularly I'm thinking of, social service kind of organizations, still ultimately does come from the government, either from the federal or state or local government?
It really does depend. I don't have those kind of statistics. What I do know is that in communities of color, often, Black, Latino, Asian, Native American communities, that the budgets are overwhelmingly government. So that small percentage that comes from private dollars, there's a lot less flexibility than in mainstream organizations where, let's say you have, and I don't even know if this is true, just a hypothetical food bank, if half the budget comes from government and half comes from individual donors, then when there are things like a 9/11 or when there are things that impact people's giving patterns or if there's a crisis in the government, like the government's at war, that government contracts, you know, ebb and flow, that the organizations that don't have a lot of private money, they can really feel the hit. You know, if you're 95% government funded and then you lose contracts, I mean, you're really going to feel it. But if you're 60% government funded, then that 40% you can be flexible with. Okay, so what we've seen in the Asian community, that most community-based organizations are heavily government funded. Ours was about 80, 85%, so it wasn't too bad, but still wasn't great.
Yeah. We are past the midpoint. In fact, we're going into about our last 15 minutes here in this part of Focus 580. But I would certainly want to introduce again our guest, John Menzon Santos. He, in 2006, established this consulting practice that we have talked about a little bit, Pearl Diving, in which he works with individuals and organizations and trying to develop their strategies to raise money and to provide services. He, from 91 to 2006, served as executive director of the Asian and Pacific Islander Wellness Center, that's in the San Francisco Bay Area, and also the Asian and Pacific Islander Coalition on HIV/AIDS in New York City. And these are the two biggest nonprofits in North America that focus on Asian and Pacific Island communities around the issues of sexual health and HIV. He also worked for a couple of years as a counselor and trainer at Project Reach, a multiracial youth organizing center in Manhattan's Lower East Side, and has worked with a lot of other different kinds of organizations as well. He was here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk. This was the inaugural Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights and Asian Americans. We'll now go forward here. One of these talks will happen every year. He was talking in his talk, and this was last night on the U of I campus, about some of his experiences doing this kind of activist work in the nonprofit sector. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455.
David, if I could say, yeah, I mean, sure, you know, sure. Working in these community-based organizations in the Asian and Pacific Islander community, one of the terrific things has been...
Is that your phone? No. Okay.
What? Maybe it's a caller calling in. Is that we try and have a partnership with all other sectors and other parts of the community, and that includes academia, which sometimes can be very distant from those of us in the grassroots or in the community at large. But, you know, and this started with the ethnic studies movement in colleges and universities in the late 60s. But I was invited here to Champaign-Urbana by the Asian American Studies Program, which is one of the top five in the nation and the largest one in the Midwest. And they focus on a lot of very important issues to the Asian American community that includes what a lot of nonprofits are doing. So this lecture, what's significant about it, the endower, Dr. Balgopal and his wife, wanted to raise awareness around human rights and Asian Americans and invite people each year to speak about issues from the community's perspective, not necessarily an academic perspective, so that you have this dialogue between academics and folks out in the community. So, you know, just if I wasn't invited by the Asian American Studies program, then the students who are taking Asian American Studies in the classrooms are not going to have they're going to get what's in the books, they're going to get what's in the research, and they also get perspectives of folks that are, you know, on the ground, so to speak, on the street. And I've got to hand it to the Asian American Studies program. They also have tremendous expertise in areas like sexuality and gender and mental health and performance and education and politics, all the different aspects of civic life and intellectual life. And they've been around for 10 years. They're going into their second decade. And I think what's promising about this particular lecture series is, again, there's the risk of academics being in the ivory tower, you know, and conducting research in a vacuum. But Asian American communities are so relatively small that we have the opportunity to have this dialogue, and not just one lecture a year, but they're doing programming all year round. Especially in March is the Asian American Heritage Month, Awareness Month. So there's a whole bunch of programming that's happening starting on Saturday.
Yeah. Something I would like to give you the chance to talk about, one of the things that really comes across very strongly, and I had a chance to look at what was the rough draft of the talk that you gave last night, is this idea, your idea that equating activist work with human rights, and the idea that being a grassroots social activist here in the United States, working among in the Asian community or any other community, is in the way that you see it, is part in a larger sense part of the struggle for work towards human rights. In you know, how do you make that connection, particularly between, you know, something that you might do here in the United States and the much larger sort of frame?
Well, I think a lot of times when we talk about human rights, it's something that the U.S. doesn't do, actually. We think about human rights being the purview of the United Nations, for example. It's something very international. It's something that other countries do. It's something that abuses and violations are done by other countries. You know, we talk about China. We talk about Burma. We talk about you know, these other places, these are the countries that the U.S. tries to hold accountable. But at its root, human rights work is addressing people's basic human needs. And if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they talk about things like being safe and having access to food and having access to medical care and being in a situation where you don't experience discrimination. I mean, just on down the line, there are things that I think all of us would agree that all human beings should have access to. Now, in the United States, even in metropolitan areas, cities like the ones that I've worked with, we see the same exact basic human needs that aren't being addressed. And so in some circles, we will call that justice work or social justice work or economic justice work. But it's also human rights work. I talked earlier in the program about stigma. And when people cannot get services, or if they cannot have their dignity validated because of a certain a health condition or a race or a religion or a gender identity, a sexual orientation, all of that, that's violation of one's right to be human. And so that's the connection, why the activism work that I felt that I've been engaged in and so many people are, is human rights work. But we just don't use that term as often in the United States. So part of it's just that we don't say that. Mm-hmm. But it's about basic human needs, and it's about making connections with other human beings. And sometimes we talk about that legally. You know, if people are being discriminated against and we pass a law, I mean, that's a human rights advance, you know? I also think the other connection, and going back to HIV/AIDS, when people are not getting care, I mean, and only because they have a condition that has a lot of misunderstanding and discrimination around it, you know, the stigma. It's both a stigma and a medical issue. When people are denied that because the government doesn't know, and this is early on, I mean, those are basic human rights violations. So, I mean, it's not to wrap my work or other people's social justice work in a cloak of human rights because it sounds somehow more lofty. It's the kind of things, you know, we're following torture victims, you know, that. But I would argue, too, that, and by way of example, we worked with Burmese, HIV-positive Burmese refugees who came to the United States. And part of what they experienced getting out of Burma and being in refugee camps was torture. And for them to come here and be served as HIV-positive people, and if we could understand a bit about their whole situation, which included what they, the harrowing experiences that they had to deal with in the camps, then that's a way of connecting with them and accepting and embracing their whole person. And we firmly believe that that's human rights work. Hmm.
We have a couple of minutes left. You know, here in the United States, I think we have always liked to say that we believe in pluralism as a principle. It's not always easy to do it, but we say that we believe in it at least. And I wonder how you think we're doing and whether you actually see some progress in developing a kind of society where we are more accepting of differences.
That's a great doorknob question, as we say. It depends on who the we is, right? We're a pretty centrist place these days. So I think there's more awareness, more exposure, especially, you know, if you look at young people in school. I mean, just looking, you know, people are more, you know, you're more likely to see young gay and lesbian and transgender people in school. So on the one hand, I'd say, yeah, people are, it is a more pluralistic society. On the other hand, a month ago, a young 15-year-old named Lawrence King was shot in the head twice. He was 15. He was in the computer lab, and this is in L.A. area, by another student around the same age. So, you know, are we that much more accepting? I don't know. It depends. You know, what was the school system doing or not doing? You know, what do we all need to learn from that? So sometimes we're more accepting of differences, and you know, clearly we have a long way to go. I think it's interesting in the presidential debates, you know, it's really a rush to the center. You know, people aren't too radical. You know, they're not going out on a limb too much. And so I think there's pluralism within, you know, a safety zone. Mm-hmm. And I think we're yet to hear, at least people who are getting the media attention, how much... you know, the kind of policies that need to change and for that pluralist society to really come to fruition.
Mm. Well, how on the off chance, for example, that Barack Obama should become president of the United States, how significant would it be, do you think, to have a person of color as the president of the United States?
Oh, my gosh. It would be tremendous. It'd be tremendous for a biracial black man to be president. I think what's important is the potential, the possibility of when you see someone in the Oval Office who doesn't look like everybody else who's been president, it means that, maybe there is a chance. And really what we're investing in is hope, especially with elected leaders at that top level. Look, when you are, you know, people say, well, you know, can he be a manager? Can he be a leader? You know, he would be a great symbolic leader, and he would be a great actual leader because he's really, really smart. And he's going to have the people around him who are going to do all the jobs that he can do. And for all the people in the country who can see that even this nation can have a person of color in the White House, that's going to say that a lot of things are possible. We don't know what exactly, but it's like water on a stone. You know, if we can keep those drops going, you know, it's going to, you know, to continue the metaphor, I mean, really flood, whether it's justice or, you know, if a black man can be in the White House, then maybe a gay person can be in the White House. Maybe, you know, a gay black person can be in the White House. Maybe it doesn't matter who's in the White House, but that what's more important to me versus there being a black man in the White House is if this country fights racism, you know, because there can be a black man in the White House and racism can still be what it is today. So it's about the system discrimination, not necessarily the symbolic leader only.
And for yourself, what you think that you're going to continue to do the same kinds of work that now you've been doing for the last couple of decades?
I like to say that I'm constantly becoming an activist, so that I expect that to continue around the issues that are important to what's going on in my life and in the lives of people I care about and the communities I care about. So my job is to stay fresh and not burn out as an activist. And so that I'll continue to do.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much, David.
Our guest, John Menzon Santos, he's here on the Champaign-Urbana campus to give the inaugural lecture, the first Balgopal lecture on human rights in Asian Americans. We'll be going on now once a year for a long time, hopefully, talking about issues of things like marginality and oppression experience within the Asian American communities. Thanks very much again for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.